Good afternoon and welcome to the Expert Second Opinion. Investigators provide perspective on the management of HER2-positive GYN cancers. I'm Dave O'Malley and I'll be moderating today's session. And this is our faculty today, Dr. Joyce Liu from the Dana-Farber and Brian Slomovitz from Mount Sinai Medical Center in Miami. They're both my very good friends. We're going to refer to each other by our first names today in the conversation. Here's our relative disclosures. And as well as we have videos from other experts in the field bringing up cases that we'll also discuss. I'd like to thank our commercial support, a grant from AstraZeneca, as well as Daiichi Sankyo. Again, this is a CME activity and they had no influence on the content. And this, the RTP group has no conflicts of interest. Remember that we will be using non-FDA-approved uses of agents, essentially the entire conversation today, but please refer to the prescribing within the FDA. So, let's get started. I think as we look here and we really look at the impact of HER2-positive GYN cancers, we really have an impact with the FDA accelerated approval in 3+ HER2-positive. But more and more trials are being conducted, and the opportunities for us in the future are going to be great for our patients. We did something different this year. We actually asked other thought leaders, experts in our field, for questions about difficult cases that they've encountered. And so Dr. Love actually interviewed Dr. Jonathan Lederman from the University College of London Cancer Institute, Dr. Angelos Alvarez-Sagord from Duke, and Dr. Ursuline Matulonis, the chief at Dana-Farber. And the person Joyce calls the boss, right? Yeah. All right. So, you know, it's always tough to answer questions from your boss, but we're going to do the best job we can. We have three separate modules. We will be done on time, right at a quarter past the hour. We're going to look at strategies to identify patients with HER2-positive GYN cancers. We're going to look at the available applications, data and applications, on that HER2-directed therapy, Dr. Slomovitz. And then I will follow up with identification and management of adverse. And in there, we're also going to have these vignettes to lead our discussion. So without further ado, Dr. Joyce Liu, thank you.
Nice job.
Thank you so much, and thank you for everybody for attending. I'm going to talk about how we identify patients with HER2-positive GYN cancers, and there's a reason I put positive in quotes here. The agenda, going through HER2 biology and the significance of HER2 addiction, what does it mean to be HER2-positive in this day and age? And talking a little bit about what we know about HER2 expression in GYN cancers and considerations for HER2 testing in this ADC era. I'm going to start by talking about the biology of HER2 because this is really important for how we think about HER2 positivity. I think we're all very familiar with HER2 at this point. It's encoded by the gene ERBB2. That's a member of the EGFR family, and it doesn't have a known direct ligand. So signaling through HER2 is not mediated by ligand binding. Instead, HER2 activates through dimerization and cross-phosphorylation with the other EGFR family members, either because the presence of their ligands binding causing heterodimerization, or when there's enough receptor density on the cell, so a lot of high expression, HER2 will homodimerize with itself, cross-phosphorylate and signal, or it will heterodimerize with other EGFR family members. And so when we think about HER2 high expression, that's where HER2 signaling can mediate itself. So that leads to this idea of HER2 amplification. How do you get a lot of copies of HER2? Well, you have HER2 amplification and the concept of HER2 addiction. And why is that important? So if you think about HER2 non-amplified cancer cells, they might have some HER2 on the receptor surface, HER2 receptor on the surface. They might have a little bit of heterodimerization or homodimerization and a little bit of signaling, but they're not dependent upon this for their growth and signaling. They have other pathways that they're using to promote cell growth and survival. That's in contrast to a HER2 amplified cell, where because there's a lot of copies of HER2 on the surface, they have a lot of HER2-mediated signaling that's driving that those downstream signaling effects and promoting the cell growth, survival, and growth. So when we first started developing HER2-directed therapies, it was a HER2-directed monoclonal antibody, trastuzumab, that was the first that really came into this space. And when it was used, you can have trastuzumab in this HER2 non-amplified cell. Trastuzumab will bind to the HER2 on the surface of the cell, but it's not abrogating any significant cellular signal of growth and survival. So maybe it stops it a little bit, but the cell has other pathways by which it's mediating its growth and survival. That's in contrast to your HER2 amplified cancer cell, where now the trastuzumab binding is breaking up those homodimers and those heterodimers that were helping promote growth and survival in the setting of HER2 amplification and high receptor density, and it abrogates all those cells. These cells are now really dependent on this pathway and are vulnerable to the effects of this. If you think about it this way, you would think, well, a drug like trastuzumab is not going to be active in HER2 non-amplified tumors. And in fact, that was what was seen in breast cancer. This is data from over 20 years ago, where trastuzumab monotherapy had limited or no activity at all in HER2 non-amplified breast cancer, both as a monoclonal antibody, as a monotherapy. And then when you added trastuzumab to chemotherapy, there was no progression-free survival or overall survival benefit in these HER2 non-amplified breast cancers. And the conclusion that we all took from this as well, HER2 non-amplified breast cancers aren't addicted to HER2 signaling, and therefore they're insensitive to HER2-directed therapies. That was true of those therapies that were available at that time, and this led to this definition of HER2-positive disease being HER2-amplified, IHC3+, or 2+, and positive by FISH as the biomarker for trastuzumab activity. But the world has changed, and now we have HER2-directed antibody-drug conjugates, and these can be a vulnerability. So HER2 in this setting can be a vulnerability independent of HER2 addiction or amplification. So a HER2 non-amplified cancer cell with a HER2-directed ADC, it's going to bind, it's going to internalize, and so you will still have release of the cytotoxic payload for the cell, even though it's non-addicted, just like you will for the HER2-amplified cancer cell. And so there is the potential for activity of ADCs in these non-amplified, non-addicted cells. And when we look at this in the breast cancer literature, this is exactly what we saw. Revisiting HER2 as a biomarker with T-DXd, the DESTINY-Breast04 data, which were the randomized phase 3 data, HER2 low metastatic breast cancer in second or third line, T-DXd outperforming chemotherapy. In the DAISY trial, again, second line or more metastatic breast cancer, you can see these waterfall plots of significant activity in HER2 1+, 2+ tumors, and even in this IHC0 class of what became known as HER2 ultra-low tumors. And then in the DESTINY-Breast06 trial, first-line treatment of HER2-low metastatic breast cancer, you can see, again, T-DXd outperforming the standard of care in that setting, including in the ultra-low tumors. So ADCs are leveraging HER2 as a delivery mechanism independent of biological HER2 dependency or addiction. How do we assess HER2 expression? Traditionally, it's by the ASCO CAP guidelines, which has two components, IHC, and then in situ hybridization. And I think many of us have looked at in situ hybridization. There's two components to it. It's a probe that binds to HER2 and to CEP17, which is a centromeric marker on the chromosome. And what you're looking at is overall HER2 copies, and then what's the ratio of the HER2 copies to that centromeric sort of marker, because that lets you know, is this a focal amplification, or do you just have a lot of copies of chromosome 17 where HER2 is located? The definitions for this vary by different cancer types, and so you can see there's endometrial-specific criteria, there's the breast ASCO CAP criteria, which have evolved over time, there's the gastric criteria, and you'll hear when people are talking about HER2 testing, they say IHC by gastric criteria, this is why. As you can see, these are not exactly the same. They have different cutoffs in terms of positivity, the endometrial-specific criteria, which are based upon the 2007, I believe, breast ASCO CAP criteria, are greater than or equal to 30% for 3+, whereas the current breast and gastric guidelines are 10%. And they were used differently in the different trials. So the Amanda Nichols-Fader trial of carboplatin paclitaxel trastuzumab in newly diagnosed or first-line treatment of advanced and recurrent endometrial cancer used the 2007 ASCO CAP breast criteria, which is similar to the endometrial-specific criteria. The currently ongoing ENERGY-GY026 trial is using the 2018 ASCO CAP breast criteria for its definition of HER2 positivity, and the DESTINY-PanTumor02 trial, which supports the use of T-DXd, used the gastric criteria but only the IHC component and did not include the in situ hybridization component. So these are things to be aware of as we talk about HER2 positivity. So in summary, HER2 positivity is context dependent. Historically, we said HER2 positive to refer to HER2 amplified tumors by IHC and ISH criteria, but sometimes now you'll hear it used interchangeably. I hear people use HER2 positive to mean HER2 2 plus and 3 plus positive by IHC expression, DESTINY-PanTumor02 data. I hear people say HER2 positive to mean IHC 3 plus expression. Positive or negative can vary depending upon the definition, the context you're using it with. A tumor that is HER2 positive for trastuzumab deruxtecan by HER-PanTumor02 criteria might have been HER2 negative when you evaluated the patient as a candidate for first-line therapy with carboplatin, paclitaxel, and trastuzumab. So when you're reading that pathology report, if it says positive, you have to ask where's that definition coming from? What about the expression of HER2 within GYN cancers? What do we know? Our data are still a little bit more limited. Most historical series in ovarian cancer don't distinguish between 0 and 1 plus cancers. What we do see is that HER2 amplification is rare in high-grade serous ovarian cancer. That's probably about 5%. That's IHC 3 plus. And the highest levels of HER2 expression are in the mucinous and clear cell histologies. But as you can see from here, we do see a wide range of HER2 expression across the different ovarian cancer histologies. Similarly, in endometrial cancer, we think about HER2 amplification and expression rate as being the highest in the uterine serous and the carcinosarcomas and the P53 mutated cancers, but you can see that HER2 expression is seen across the histologies and the molecular subtypes, as you can see from that graph on the right-hand side. In cervical cancer, we have currently the least amount of data. There's limited data around sort of the prevalence in general. The overexpression seems to be about 4 to 12%. The highest rates are in certain histologic types, including HER2 amplification in gastric-type cervical cancer. So these are sort of where we are right now with the data. We have to continue to build our understanding of HER2 expression in the GYN cancers. What are our challenges as we're moving ahead? Well, different than breast cancer, GYN cancers have a lot of intratumoral heterogeneity when you look at the HER2 testing. So this is actually a panel of endometrial cancers that are shown right up here. This comes from a series from Memorial Sloan Kettering, and you can see that each of these bars is a cancer, but you can see it's not uniformly all negative or moderate or strong. Every cancer has, or many of these cancers have, a whole distribution of cells in terms of what their sort of expression of HER2 is. So there's a lot of intratumoral heterogeneity. And this can come in different patterns. So there's cluster patterns where you can have part of the tumor that's all positive and part of the tumor that's negative, or a mosaic pattern where you can have a positive cell in a sea of negative cells. And you can imagine when you're thinking about an ADC and bystander effect that this might matter in terms of how well an ADC would work. There's also challenges in terms of intratest variability. This is data from the DESTINY-Breast06 sample looking at HER2 low samples, but you can see here that in this area there's significant discordance between central testing and local testing for HER2 positivity. And we saw that also today in the presentation of the trastuzumab pemirtecan data, where we saw that there was discordance between the local and the central testing. What about alternative testings? Could you do NGS instead? Well, NGS can identify copy number amplifications or mutations in ERBB2, but almost all ERBB2 amplified tumors are going to demonstrate high HER2 expression. That being said, the converse is not true. HER2 high expressing cancers may not have detectable amplification by NGS, and NGS is not going to help you detect low or moderate IHC 1 plus or 2 plus HER2 expression levels. So where does that leave us? This is sort of, if I was thinking about clinical HER2 testing in GYN cancers today, I consider HER2 testing for all of my recurrent GYN cancers and all of my advanced GYN cancers, given that there's T-DXd FDA approval and the HER2 IHC3 plus tumors, an NCCN listing in HER2 IHC2 plus and 3 plus GYN cancers. Remember that for T-DXd use, Destiny Pan-Tumor2 used gastric IHC criteria. I do test for HER2 in my newly diagnosed advanced recurrent P53 mutated endometrial cancers with the consideration of adding trastuzumab using the criteria that were used in the Nichols-Fader study. And then finally, I consider HER2 retesting for recurrent disease if it's feasible, because there's a lot of intratumoral heterogeneity in intratest variability, and we see temporal changes over time. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you, Joyce.
Yes, Jeff.
So I have so many questions, but let's first go to our videos and see some of the questions that we have from our other experts.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice. And to make this CME meeting more relevant and practical, I met separately with three noted clinical investigators, Professor Jonathan Lederman from the UCL Cancer Institute in London, United Kingdom, Dr. Ursula Matalonis from the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston, and Dr. Angela Secord from the Duke Cancer Institute in Durham, North Carolina, to brainstorm about clinical scenarios and related research data sets in HER2-positive gynecologic cancers to present to the faculty for their input. To begin, Dr. Lederman has a 58-year-old woman with a BRCA1 germline mutation and platinum and PARP inhibitor-resistant metastatic ovarian cancer with a low folate receptor alpha level, but a HER2 IHC of 1+, bringing up the issue of quantitative HER2 expression and benefit from T-DXd.
We still don't really know what the cutoff is in terms of expression and benefit. We've seen different conflicting data, so I think understanding that better would be important. You know, do we need to worry about the degree of staining or not? And, you know, what is the best cutoff to use?
I'm just wondering how often the panelists have seen ERBB2 mutations, and if they had a patient with the mutation, are there any specific tyrosine kinase inhibitors or other targeted therapies they would recommend?
So great questions. So Joyce, I mean, the breast cancer literature we've learned so much from. And you said, what is positive, what is negative? And it really drives me nuts when I get that result back from the pathologist and they say negative. Don't tell me what negative is. I'm not even sure. Tell me what the scoring is on the HER2. So what, how, you know, you put your synopsis up there, but when... what testing are you considering positive, and should we change our nomenclature so that we're all talking about the same thing?
Yeah, so I think that this is, yeah, we work with our pathologists about this, but I think, first of all, I think we are in an age we shouldn't be calling it IHC positive and negative. Like, we should have the IHC 0, 1 plus, 2 plus, 3 plus, and then we also need a notation. What criteria were you using to call that sort of 0, 1 plus, 2 plus, 3 plus? Because the cutoffs are different.
Right.
And so that's what we ask for, and that's what we're doing at our center.
So I was working with the breast oncologist, actually doing a similar session to this, and the breast oncologist, I was surprised, and they said, oh, I just keep sending tissue until I get a positive result. I mean, you retest it, you said consider it. So what's your consideration?
So I usually will retest if it's been some period of time, I have a recurrent cancer, and, you know, I'm trying to see, is T-DXd something I should consider? Do I want to use a HER2-directed therapy? I will consider rebiopsying. I don't know about testing until positivity, although I know that some people will think about it. I think I use it to give myself information about, should I think about T-DXd? Is it going to be beneficial? If they started at 2+, I might test again, because if it's IHC 0, maybe that patient is not going to benefit from T-DXd in that second-line setting or third-line setting, and especially as we have more ADCs that come to sort of our availability, that may also continue to change how we think.
But you showed us the breast cancer literature, that person still may get benefit, so I'm going to leave it there and not let you respond. Brian, all right, so you're going to tell us a lot about the ongoing phase 3 trials and some of the data that supported them. You work with a ton of community oncologists in the Miami area. What do you see as the real world? And what advice do you have on patients, on practitioners with regards to testing and clinical trials?
Yeah, no, thanks for that question, Dave. And you're right. We're there's one thing that we're doing like on trials, and then there's what's going on in the real world. I think in general, more and more folks are testing. And when I say testing, probably what's alluded to here, high-risk histologies, advanced or recurrent disease. A lot of folks are using the commercial testing. Some of them are using their own lab testing. And, I think it's good to have the information. More importantly, though, or equally as importantly, what we talked about, you just alluded to, intra-patient variability, the tumors are heterogeneous. But there's a tremendous amount of inter-lab variability. If what we're getting as a 1+ or a 2+ in our local lab, we could send it in for a clinical trial and it could be 3+.
That's a great point.
So I think we really need to be careful there. I really like the data. I don't rebiopsy, but when I'm looking to see if a patient's eligible for trastuzumab deruxtecan, I'll start off at the testing in their endometrial biopsy, in their hysterectomy, maybe their recurrent biopsy. And if one of those is positive, I want to get the patient the drug, so I'll use that one when I'm getting insurance. I'm not doing repeat biopsies, but I'm using all the results available.
But that's interesting. If you send the primary tumor from the uterus, but they had a metastatic lesion, you may ask them to send that metastatic lesion to retest. We do it in our own institution, so it's easier to do that. But that's one of the things I'll do. I'll say, well, the metastatic lesion is driving, particularly on recurrence, obviously. So Joyce, on Jonathan's case, let's say there's a 2+. Now, my pathologists sometimes are sending FISH without even me asking them to. Are you going to send FISH on that? It was a 1+, but let's say it was a 2+.
Yeah, so I think it depends upon context, right? Like 2+ FISH with reflex testing is the sort of old age, tried and true way of saying this is a HER2 amplified tumor. I think that, when you're thinking about giving TDXD, you don't need to do that ISH reflex testing. But if you're looking and you're trying to understand, do I have an amplified tumor, then yes, that reflex testing with the ISH is going to tell you whether or not you have amplification.
Right. Yeah, no, and that's great. I looked at it a lot more simply. For ADCs, we need the anchor. So the protein on the outside is enough. For the trastuzumab, it's more of a functional assay, so we need to have the amplification to see if we interrupt the pathway, we'll get that response. But it's really the anchor of the ADCs. I don't test the FISH in that setting.
Right. So that's why I was saying it's context. If this was newly diagnosed, I would want to know whether or not there was.
And we're saying the same thing. Yeah. A little simpler than you. I'm not as smart.
So Brian, we're going to get into a little bit more of the data in GYN. Joyce, I love those slides with regards to the breast across that, really showing, what do we need to be assessing as we move forward. And as we get more data on the other HER2-directed ADCs, in other ADCs, we may be able to answer some of these questions. I get asked this all the time, Joyce, all the time. Am I using liquid biopsy? I don't think you had any slides on that. What's your opinion?
I don't use liquid biopsy for HER2 assessment, because it's expression that matters, especially for the ADCs.
Okay, so expression matters, doesn't go from there, and we're not going to do liquid biopsies on that. The other thing we have to be very, very careful of in our GYN cancers, they don't seem to have as much sloughing. So, we're not even sure what that means right now. So I think it's an important question. So, Brian, we kind of alluded to this. If you have a patient who has a biopsiable lesion, you kind of alluded to it. Are you rebiopsying that patient if their HER2 was negative to begin with?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think there's always value in having more information, but at the same time, we don't want to put our patients under unnecessary procedures. I think then I'll consider clinically what was the time from her diagnosis to her recurrence. And if it's a considerable amount of time, and then you'll ask, what does that mean? I don't know, maybe 12 months, then I'll consider rebiopsy. Because of the heterogeneity of the tumor, I want to make sure I'm treating the current tumor, not the historical uterus.
So we're getting a lot of questions online with regards to OnePlus. I don't want you to answer it yet. I want to see Brian's presentation, but I want you to think in this, you know, the NCCN guidelines are 2 and 3 plus for us in the GYN cancers. We have the FDA approval, accelerated approval, which is 3 plus, but I'm really curious to see what your take is on the OnePlus. You know, Angelus asked, you know, how about some of the other TKIs? And the tucapnib trastuzumab data, which actually looked really good in triple negative breast and gastric cancer, was very modest. We presented that at ESMO, and I don't think you have any slides on that. But, you know, there is some possibilities out there. They're not NCCN listing, but it's quite modest at less than 20% response rate. But I think in this next generation of TKIs, may there be an opportunity there. So it's really an insightful question. And Angela's kind of, you know, made me think, like, okay, would we consider that potentially after post-ADC? And I think we'll talk a little bit more about WEE1, and Ursula asked a question about that. We'll come back to. So as a perfect segue, for Dr. Brian Slovitz to talk about available data with the practical applications of HER2-directed therapy in advanced GYN cancers. Thanks, Brian.
Thanks, bud. Yes, sir.
Yeah,
thanks for the opportunity to present to you. I really enjoy working with Joyce and Dave, so excited to be here and talking about this really hot topic of what's going on today in the world. You know, there's a lot focusing on the ADCs, particularly these targeted ADCs. So just to get going, I think this slide, I don't want to go through the details of this slide, but this really shows us the history of approvals for HER2-targeted therapies. There's a lot there, right? And as far as the mechanisms, you know, there's the tyrosine kinase inhibitors, the monoclonal antibodies, antibody-drug conjugates. We're getting into bispecifics now. So it's really important to show how many are here, to look at the opportunities here, and to show it's not just the one pathway. Right, we talked about TKIs and ADCs, but there's a lot more there. And you can see as we move forward in time, there's more and more opportunities. And I'll see that especially as we move forward in GYN, we're going to see more of these opportunities. I think that the first, when we're going through the history of GYN, I think it's first to highlight the great work that was led by Amanda's Nichols-Fader, one of our ex-SGO former SGO presidents, where she did a randomized phase 2 trial looking at those patients with advanced stage disease. They defined IHC here 3+ or 2+ with FISH, right? So it required the amplification, unlike the ADCs, which we're going to go to. And simply what they found in this trial, there was an overall survival benefit, particularly striking in the newly diagnosed 3 and 4 patients compared to the recurrent patients. And the median overall survival was 25.4 months versus not reached. Sending us an early signal, sending us an NCCN listing that interrupting this pathway could help our patients. And it's been incorporated into a lot of the care that we offer to our patients. So much so that the results of this phase 2 trial led to this NRG ongoing trial, GY026. Joyce mentioned it. It's a 3-arm trial, carboplatin-paclitaxel, trastuzumab, and the same with pertuzumab. The issues here, as we change the standard of care, and I think this is the issue of doing a lot of trials over time, the control arm could change. Paclitaxel carboplatin alone as opposed to the GY018 regimen. And obviously there's a lot of thought in our mind about what about T-DXd? Simple put there, patients treated with T-DXd were treated with Herceptin, trastuzumab, I'm sorry, and it still has activity there. So we're excited to see as the study moves forward what the results are. By the way, Britt Erickson's doing a great job in leading this study. I'm going to show you slides now that you've all seen before. They're in almost so many of our talks because it deals with the treatment of endometrial cancer, ovarian cancer, cervical cancer, biomarker testing. But it's really exciting data. And the GYN aspect of this was really led by Vicky Macker, who's been a leader in this area. This is the phase 2 DESTINY PanTumor 2 study of trastuzumab deruxtecan, these HER2-expressing solid tumors, and you could see them all listed here. The design and analysis, you could see here, this was patients with advanced solid tumors not eligible for curative therapy, second line or higher. In the part one section, the IHC was 3+ or IHC 2+ by local testing or central testing. In part two or cohort B, the results were by central assessment as predefined for each cohort. primary, and this data has been published, and it really changed the world in our acceptance of this agent as we move forward for the treatment of our disease. Primary endpoints, overall response rate. And as we can see here, the final analysis was very similar to the initial analysis, but the final analysis was presented just last year. Across tumor types, 3+ positivity, endometrial cancer, 85%, 75% cervical cancer, 3+, ovarian cancer, 63.6. I said this quickly, but I'll say it again, heavily pretreated group of patients. Okay, in a heavily pretreated group of patients, we saw these type of results. We're confirmed ORR. It's a phase 2 trial, so it was very, very similar there based on the final analysis, not much different from the primary analysis. When we look at here, progression-free survival and the overall survival, the PFS and the OS data were consistent across the primary and final analyses. Data was consistent regardless of HER2 testing was performed, whether essential testing was applied or not. So when we now as we move forward, we want to also not only look at the high expressors, okay, but what about the low expressors? In this category, cohort C, D, E, again, these were locally tested to be high, but centrally tested, they were 1+ or 2+. Did we see activity, or was it a complete waste of time? And here's this data. Numbers are low, but we're looking for signals. When we look for signals, you could see from the left to the right, zero score had activity. 1+ has activity. 2+ has activity. We talked about the 3+ activity, but it's demonstrating, and I always like to say, you know, in GYN, we're not that smart all the time. Sorry, Dave, sorry. But we follow the lead of breast cancer docs, and they're already looking at the lower expressors, and they're seeing activity, and we're going in that direction. I'll talk about data that was even presented as recently as this morning. So, you know, this is showing that the lower expressors can have activity. Granted, now remember, Joyce highlighted what's approved, 3+ FDA approval, 2+ or 3+ NCCN listing, but there's definitely activity here which we need to focus on. On the right, and this was really an amazing trial, I thought. They looked at some of the carcinosarcomas, and there, too, they saw activity in tumor shrinkage in those patients when we interrupted this pathway as well. So where does that bring us? This was the early study, but this said, okay, guys, there's an opportunity in gynecologic cancers to make a difference. Here, this is the PMMR data across the 4 different studies, and here there's definitely an unmet need. It is a standard of care, chemo-IO. I'm not going to go against that, but there's definitely an opportunities here to fill an unmet need and coming up with better opportunities for our patients in the first line. And here's DESTINY-01. Okay, this is Destiny Endometrial 01, and here's the study design. A couple of things to highlight here. IHC, not FISH, 2+ or 3+. It's an opportunity to get rid of carboplatin paclitaxel in the first line. So this is a treatment trial. There's another first line trial that's ongoing, which we're not going to get into. A good approach to the maintenance setting, but here we're trying to see if we can get rid of carboplatin paclitaxel. The control arm is ARM-C, carboplatin paclitaxel pembrolizumab. The two experimental arms, trastuzumab deruxtecan, pembrolizumab. In addition, we're testing a new bispecific anti-PD-L1 anti-TIGIT, RILV, I call it, with trastuzumab deruxtecan in arm A. Primary endpoint here is progression-free survival. Secondary endpoints are listed. We're capping the 2+ patients. But imagine this, you know, if this is positive, it's a superiority trial. We're bringing patients in. We're giving patients a better therapy in the first line. But imagine here if we push carboplatin paclitaxel to a second line treatment. We're always thinking about sequential management. That's a pretty strong second line agent that they haven't received. So we're really excited about this. It's a biomarker directed first line trial. We're excited about biomarkers as we move forward. And my role in the GOG as the uterine cancer lead, we're sort of navigating all these trials that we're going through. But biomarker specific, it's really exciting to see what was going on. Then in everything we do, okay, it works in the second line. Now we're moving TDXC to first line. Let's see at the same time, maybe there's an opportunity here to move into the adjuvant setting. We know that the first time we treat patients is the best time to make a difference. We did Keynote B21. You all remember those results. Adjuvant trial, carboplatin paclitaxel, plus minus pembrolizumab. Summary, it was a negative trial. So the standard of care still in the adjuvant setting is carboplatin paclitaxel, but we need to see if we can make a difference in this setting. And what that did, and there's a great opportunity here, is an adjuvant trial, DESTINY-Endometrial-02. What this is looking at is looking at the 2+ or 3+ patients, again, biomarker-directed, treating patients with, in the adjuvant setting, 1-to-1 randomization, carboplatin paclitaxel versus trastuzumab deruxtecan. The trastuzumab deruxtecan duration is 12 months, carboplatin paclitaxel 6 months. But again, if this is a positive trial, maybe we're moving the ADC into the adjuvant setting, and then will be the argument of ADC after ADC and payload after payload. Not enough time to talk about that today. In the ovarian cancer space, we're investigating trastuzumab deruxtecan. Here's a prospective randomized phase 3 trial. Patients with HER2 expression, 1+, 2+, or 3+. Okay, they needed to have high-grade ovarian, fallopian tuber, primary endometrial cancer, non-progressive disease after completion of frontline therapy. Patients are randomized here to T-DXd with bevacizumab versus bevacizumab alone. And we want to see if we can incorporate T-DXd into the maintenance setting for these patients. Again, different disease from endometrial, exciting opportunity. Let's see if we can make a difference. No prospective studies yet in cervical cancer. But again, in our clinic, we're treating them. Remember, cervical cancer patients, albeit less percentage, there's an opportunity there. Give a lot of credit to our colleague, Dr. Bob Mithpathuri. She presented some of this data this morning on BNT323 or DB1303. This is previous data that was presented actually by another close colleague, Dr. Katie Moore, looking at the HER2 expressors from 1+ to 2+ to 3+ or ISH positive. And what they found here was among all the participants, the unconfirmed overall response rate was 59%, 23.5% confirmed, 35.3% pending confirmation. Unconfirmed response rate is 61.5%. Probably a class effect here, not just the T-DXd. But, you know, here's another one, trastuzumab permatecan, which has anti-tumor activity. And as mentioned, Bob presented really great data this morning. It's the press release, but the response rates across 1+, 2+, 3+ low expressors was in the mid-40s to high 40 percentile. Last but not least, this is a third prospective randomized trial. This is the FERN-EC01, BNT-323. In the recurrent setting, second line, but addressing the low expressors. 2+, 3+, NCCN listing, 3+, FDA. But here we're including the lower expressors to see if we could really exploit that population to give them better treatment options. I talked about Bobna's data, and that's available if you look online, and there's a press release out there as well. Tomorrow, Vicky's going to present some additional data for pretreated patients. That's embargoed up to this point. And I'm excited to move forward from there. Thanks, Dave.
Excellent. Great job, Brian.
Thank you.
All right, man. All right, it's getting fun now, right? I mean, my mind's, like, imagine that. I have a flight of ideas, for those who know me. So let's hear from Ursula on this. She has a really, really interesting case, and have discussion.
The next case is presented by Dr. Matalonis.
This is a 64-year-old patient of mine who has advanced to metastatic serous carcinoma of the endometrium. Her HER2 is IHC3+, treated with carboplatin paclitaxel trastuzumab initially. And about 2 years later, developed progression with peritoneal disease and then started trastuzumab deruxtecan in September of 2024 and really has had a terrific response. She continued on T-DXd for about 10 months and then eventually did have progression of cancer. So my question to the esteemed panel would be, now that she has had progression, what would you treat her with? I'd also love to hear from the panel, what other really interesting and unique options for therapies are available for endometrial serous cancer? Love to hear from Dr. Liu about the use of WEE1 inhibitors. This lady has done really well from a gastrointestinal standpoint and really remarkably well with T-DXd, probably one of the individuals who has the best tolerance of this agent. She recently was switched to weekly paclitaxel and unfortunately has had pretty significant GI toxicities.
Joyce, Ursula's calling you out, man. All right. Let's talk about some of the agents post-ADCs that you're excited about before we get to some of the other questions. And she asked, I'm like, WEE1 inhibitors, for example. So what's some of the stuff that you're looking in this post-ADC world? And I'm going to have a follow-up question after that.
Yeah, so I mean, WEE1 inhibitors are among a class of agents that's targeting replication stress. And I think the nice thing about them is that they're really looking at something that's totally different than ADCs. We're not depending upon topo-1 payload or anything like that. We know that uterine serous cancers and probably all P53 mutated endometrial cancers, there's some subset of them that have a high level of replication stress and can be vulnerable to drugs that target that. We had a trial of WEE1 inhibitors. We had a couple where there have been response rates that have been quite respectable. The durability and the toxicity sort of is something that we have to navigate. But really an area of interest.
Yeah, so Brian, Shan Weston led one of our trials in GOG. I don't think we've seen that data yet. What do you think about the post-ADC world and specifically to WEE1, but any other agents?
Yeah, no, thanks for the question. And one thing I just want to touch base on this case, which some people may be thinking, we can't forget about IOs. She hadn't had an IO yet, so lenvatinib pembrolizumab is still an option for this patient.
Great option.
But so we can't forget about the value, if not in the first line, later on with an OS benefit in Vicky Macker's 775 trial. We did do a trial, to your point, with WEE1 inhibitor with it's a Zentalis asset. We're excited about those results. The interesting thing is what demonstrated a complete need is how quickly that trial accrued. There's definitely, the trial accrued at record pace for us where we got the patients on because there's an unmet need to treat patients post-platin, post-IO, post-ADC. So we need to. The bevacizumab data from 86P is really strong, so that's another opportunity. GOG historically did a single agent bevacizumab data that's strong, weekly Taxol strong, but we need to have further opportunities there.
All right. Joyce, we're getting killed online here. We're getting a lot of comments online. There's two HER2-directed TKIs that are recently approved for breast cancer. You know, we talked about the tucatinib trastuzumab data. I mean, would you, in a patient who you know HER2 positive, would you go with an off-label use? Let's say she is not eligible for clinical trial. I know it's a tough question. It's not on the board, but we're getting it online.
Yeah, I mean, I think to Brian's point, though, I do want to point out for this patient is IO naive. Like, I would go to LenPem first. I would look at that as standard of care. I don't think that's a question.
So well before going off label, let's make sure we utilize the agents that are on label and that we have prospective phase 3 data on.
Yes.
Yes. All right. Go, please. Sorry for interrupting.
Could you use a TKI? I think that TKIs, their activity is really if you have true amplification. So I think that's where I would really think about it as sort of, is there the potential of getting activity there? We haven't proven that really that much in endometrial cancer. Dave, you have the most experience in terms of the TKIs.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the activity is modest. We presented last year's ESMO. I think it was 17.6% on the endometrial cancer. You know, I think, again, going off label use with that, we have better options available to us besides clinical trials. I really try not to do that unless there's an extreme example. Yeah. So, Brian, you know, I get this all the time, especially in referrals, where we haven't tested the protein, the IHC, but we sent NGS and ERBB2 came up.
Yeah.
So, I mean, do you then send for IHC? Do you just use that ERBB2? What's the difference between the amplification or amplified versus expression in the IHC?
Yeah, no, as we know, a lot of those are amplified are going to be IHC positive. I like to get the IHC because we also know that there's varying responses based on varying expression. So it gives us a little bit of an idea of where we're starting from, especially if I'm between two therapies, you know, 3+, I think it's a no-brainer going with a therapy. So I think it's always good to have that good information. Yes, we're getting it on the NGS, but I still look at the IHC.
All right. You guys may disagree on this, but the second question here, all right? You have a HER2-positive endometrial cancer. You decided, let's actually before that. I think this is one of the hardest decisions we make. Joyce, you alluded to this, which is you check, you get a HER2 IHC, you do reflex, they're fish. So let's say GY26 is closed. What are you doing in clinical practice with regards to that HER2-positive patient? Are you using IO or using trastuzumab with your carboplatin paclitaxel backbone in a, let's say, stage 4 serous cancer of the uterus? So not the question there, but you okay. have that. Yeah.
You've moved to a different question.
Oh,
I was
totally,
like, I was so confused. I was like, you're like, second question.
So I'm like on boards here, all right? All right, this is fun. These are the two smartest people I know. So we're getting that. Two of the smartest people. All right. What do we, so you get a 2+, positive fish. You have an endometrial cancer patient, stage 4 disease. Are you using carboplatin paclitaxel IO? Or are you using carboplatin paclitaxel trastuzumab?
In the first line.
First line.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Bye.
You go first, please.
I was say, I am using carboplatin paclitaxel trastuzumab because I can come back with IO with LenPem.
So you're thinking on that, though, we have the phase 2 data that showed overall survival benefit in published in Clinical Cancer Research, right? I was honored to be a part of that trial. You saw OS survival benefit as a phase 2. But because of that and having the option for IO therapy in the future. Brian, I think you may disagree with this.
So in the first line, obviously it goes without saying clinical trials are first option, DESTINY-01, DESTINY-01. You know, I'm a believer of, you know, stage 4B by definition is not curable. It's palliative by definition. So we need to figure out a treatment that's going to be a home run for these patients. I think that Trastuzumab is good, it's not great. I think that right now, I would give a GY018 or a Ruby-type regimen of carboplatin and paclitaxel with IO for a couple of reasons. One, again, the trastuzumab data is good, not great. They still get an opportunity for trastuzumab deruxtecan. But clinical trials, not necessarily directed by us, but directed by the FDA, the clinical trials require prior platinum therapy and prior IO in order to participate in a second-line trial, and that's where the potential home run's going to be through clinical research.
So you're saying, you know that it's required for IO. I would disagree. I think we need to change the dialogue for metastatic recurrent uterine cancers. We need to start talking about curative intent rather than palliative. Saying that MMR proficient, we have a lot of work to do on that. So Joyce, you give her trastuzumab plus the backbone carboplatin paclitaxel. She progresses, I don't know, 14 months. Are you going to go to TDXD and she's 2+ there?
I would go to LenPem after first line.
How about this? Would you have LenPem? I love that answer. Do you have apprehension of a patient who has progressed in the monoclonal antibody trastuzumab going to TDXD afterwards? Do you think it doesn't work as well?
I do not have concerns about that. I think we see this in the breast literature, right? They use trastuzumab in frontline. They have done so as a standard of care in their HER2-positive tumors for decades, and TDXD still works.
Brian, how about you?
Yeah, I think the good news is we have two options. We do have lenvatinib pembrolizumab, and we do have TDXD. A third option, you know, if you said 18 months after treatment, a third option would be retreating with carboplatin and paclitaxel. I like lenvatinib pembrolizumab, to be honest, in that setting, because I think the subgroup of the LEAP data, albeit it's not directly related to this, says it works pretty well post chemo. But, you know, I don't want to say it's a coin toss, but I think you have two options for this patient, LenPem or TDXD. And
Let's switch gears. Joyce, a trial you know a little bit about, DO1, right? Okay. So that patient who's eligible, she's not eligible for PARP, or you're not going to treat PARP. So tell us very quickly about that trial and how you're testing in that trial to make sure patients are eligible. Okay, this is now ovary. We're switching from endometrial to ovary.
So just to put in context, Destiny Ovarian 01 is a maintenance trial of T-DXd with bevacizumab in patients who are not eligible for PARP inhibitor maintenance or not appropriate for PARP inhibitor maintenance. And it is for patients with HER2 1 plus 2 plus or 3 plus tumors. I am testing our patients as soon as we have the HRD test results back. So we have local testing at my institute, so we know the HER2 status, but I'm testing the patients even if our local sort of results are not saying that they would be eligible because of that intra-test variability that we see.
All right, Brian, I want you to think about cervix cancer in the recurrent setting versus TV, but let's move on here. We're going to address some of these questions in the next segment. Can we move on to the video, please?
One of the most significant unmet needs in ovarian cancer is the patient with primary disease that's BRCA wild type and LOH negative, where outcomes are significantly inferior to patients with HRD positive tumors. And in terms of patients with HER2 positive disease, a new generation of trials are evaluating HER2 directed maintenance, including at least one study evaluating T-DXd. I asked Dr. Letterman for his thoughts on this strategy.
It's a study that's certainly worth doing, and we will have to watch the space and see how it goes. And then we're looking at maintenance, you know, which has a toxicity, how long do you give it for, you know. These are all big questions that we really don't know the answer to, which of course will come out in these maintenance studies that are now being done.
Any comments about how the gynecologic oncology world is coming up to speed on T-DXd?
This is uncharted territory for gyne-oncology, medical oncologists. You know, we could learn a lot from our breast cancer colleagues. And I think, you know, the first people I would go to actually are the breast cancer doctors and just tell me your experience of T-DXd, because they've got such a greater number of patients.
So, Joyce, we have a unique situation here. BRCA wild type, HRD, non-HRD positive or HRD negative, 3+ IHC. Would you consider, so first line, HER2 therapy in this space, and how excited are you about the current ongoing trials? I think we addressed that. Obviously, you're excited leading that trial, right? But, I mean, how would you address this patient? Would you put her on trial?
I would totally put this patient on that trial, yes.
So, In that case, we don't have trastuzumab because it's an ovary, it's not endometrial, right? Kind of slam dunk. Brian, if T-DXd would become available, again, ovary, we're ovary now, right? Mm-hmm. How long would you use it? And then, Joyce, I want to tell you about, I want you in clinical practice, and then I want you to answer what the clinical trial shows, it plans for.
No, and I think your question is asking how long to use it in the maintenance setting.
In the maintenance setting, thank you.
And that's the magic question. We don't know. And we're talking about ovary, but we looked at this at endometrial, and Destiny Endometrial 02, which is the adjuvant trial, how long do you keep it for? One of the big issues with, you know, in ADCs, we know there's a potential for side effects, but we don't know what the benefit is if there's no tumor there, i.e. the maintenance setting. So for Destiny Endometrial 02, we decided 12 months. Was there a lot of science going into it? It was sort of supported by the breast literature, but beyond that, we're not sure, and we're still not sure. Same thing for ovary. How long should we keep it on for? We're going to have to see. You know, I think it needs to be there longer than just for six cycles of chemo. But I think I don't think it's going to be indefinitely. I think it's going to be a limit, and we'll have to see. And maybe that's where ctDNA comes in. Maybe we're going to be able to use that to determine how long maintenance should be.
You know, it cracked me up early on. I was at a round table, and one of the people moderating the round table said, "Well, compared to chemotherapy." These are chemos.
Yep.
They're smarter, they're more directed, but they are chemos. So we have to keep that in mind. Joyce, how did you address that in your trial?
So Destiny Ovarian 01 has 2 years of T-DXd maintenance, and that's with the knowledge and everything that we said that we don't know how long is the right amount of time. And I think that we're going to have to learn this through experience. I think we've seen this with PARP inhibitors. We have a trial now looking at 1 versus 2 years of maintenance PARP in the frontline setting, the NRG-GY036 trial. These are the questions that are really important as we come to maintenance.
Yeah. I think in time, with regards to tolerance, also looking when our toxicities are kicking in, and then what are our events rates? I really do believe we're in a new era where we're going to start talking about curative intent for advanced metastatic disease, even biomarker negative, like MMR proficiency, like HRD positive or HRD negative. Brian, you have taught me so much about trying to sequence clinical trials. The access to these drugs, getting tomorrow's therapies today, are through clinical research.
Yep.
So tell me, in advanced metastatic disease, what should we be thinking about in the audience with all the trials that are coming back up with regards to how to sequence, get our patients the best options for these therapies?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So advanced metastatic disease in the first line setting, we want to use a clinical trial that the patients, number one, are eligible for. If it's biomarker directed, they need to have the biomarker. If they don't have the biomarker and you have a biomarker agnostic trial, to have them on that. Now, it's important. Let's consider that there's no role yet of ADC after ADC. 50% of these patients aren't going to get the ADC. So it's also important to have in your institution a second line menu of trials that could give them another ADC, biomarker positive, maybe the opportunity for that, biomarker agnostic, maybe an opportunity for that, even to in consideration of a non-ADC type trial, because different patients have different needs. And it's really important, especially now in this era that there's so many drugs we're developing in the GYN space, we want to have options for our patients. We want to advance drugs that work, and we can't discover or come up with new FDA approvals without accruing to trials. And it's important to allow the patient to get the drug, but also answer the important question, so not just treating one patient, but treating all patients.
Absolutely. And it's a great opportunity for our patients to change, not just us, but for our patients to impact generations after them. Joyce, I'm going to let you kind of... You're a medical oncologist, we're GY oncologists, you interact much more with medical oncology, and so much we've learned is from our breast cancer colleagues. But we're about to talk about toxicity, so I'm going to hold on that question. But we haven't given cervix cancer any love. We really went over it. So Brian, you've left now multiple trials in cervix cancer. Joyce, we still see it. It's still really high unmet need. So when are you, Brian, why don't you start? When are you testing for HER2 on cervix cancer? And we do have an ADC, which is available, TV.
Yeah.
When are you going to, if you did get a positivity, how are you making those decisions?
Yeah, no, thanks, Dave. So cervical cancer, I think from all the unmet needs, we need to come up with better treatment options for cervical cancer. We changed the world with A18 and A26 in the first line therapy with immunotherapy. And then we got FDA approval with tisotumab vedotin. And the bells and whistles go off. Yes, we win. We beat chemotherapy with a response rate of 8%. Our response rate for TV and TV301 was 17%. Albeit there was a 30% decreased risk of death in those patients treated with tisotumab vedotin, but there's still a need there. HER2 expression isn't so high in cervical cancer, but in those patients who are high expressors, the response rate is much higher. And the other thing I want to point out, which I really enjoy in this conversation, when we're talking about tisotumab vedotin, it's a different payload. So we're talking about ADC after ADC, it may not work. I think the conversation is going to turn into more payload after the same payload may not work, but if you're changing the kill, the chemotherapy, as you said, there may be the opportunity there. That's a long answer. Short answer, if it's HER2, 2+ or 3+, I would do that first, followed by TV.
Now I'm excited, but I can't. Neil just texted me. I know I got to answer the question when Dr. Love texts me. So we're going to switch cervix cancer. Joyce, everybody, to include Dr. Love, is saying, what are you doing with 1+ across GYN cancers?
What are we doing with 1+ across GYN cancers?
Yeah, just what? Okay, let's. So You have a patient who's diagnosed with breast cancer. Patient diagnosed with breast cancer this year. She's not eligible for clinical trial. She is struggling with, she doesn't want to lose her hair. She has already had PARP inhibitor, already had Bev, and you test her and she's 1+. Would you talk to her about T-DXd in that recurrent platinum-resistant setting?
So, full disclosure, if I can get access to it and I don't have other options, I have. But I think it's really important when we talk about activity of T-DXd or activity, we saw it this morning, of trastuzumab pemetican in HER2 1+ tumors is that there's activity. It's not as much as it is in HER2 3+ tumors. And one of the things that if you look at the PanTumor02 data and you look at the progression-free survival, right, 3+ is great. Not 3+ is not as great. And, you know, I think that we love these drugs, but I think we have to be really thoughtful about when are we benefiting. And as more ADCs come to the market that are going to have different biomarkers, different targets, there may be better targets than HER2 for across our different GYN cancers.
Well, what's interesting, Brian showed this data, and you really gave us the background with the breast cancer. And when they first came out in the 2 and 3 plus NCCN, that's before Vicky had presented that data, I literally sat down with my 7th grader and said, help me with this algebra, it's been a while. And I was like, what are 0, 1 plus? 0, 1 plus, 2 plus are all the same. So I think 3 plus is clearly differentiated, very small numbers, we have to get a lot more data. But in a patient who's not eligible for clinical trial, or they have other, I will absolutely consider it for 1+.
Definitely.
All right, let's switch gears a little bit. And, you know, we talked about, with regards to identification and management of adverse events of T-DXd, and I was asked really to speak to T-DXd. Brian alluded to some of the other data we saw this morning, but let's concentrate on T-DXd because there's been a lot of evolving data on the toxicities. We're going to look at those toxicities, spend a little time on GI myelosuppression, but really talk about some of the new data coming out with pneumonitis and retreatment. So this is now the report with regards to T-DXd across the DESTINY trials. And you see, obviously, we still have fatigue, ILD overall response in the third column, about 14%, okay? Nausea and vomiting. Even seeing grade 2s and 3s there. We also have the diarrhea and constipation. You know what, stomatitis, which I don't see in clinical practice, but actually has been reported across the DESTINY tumors, and then obviously hematologic we know so well. So this is now at 5.4, and this is almost 1,500 patients across the PanDESTINY tumor trials, the DESTINY trials. And so we have much more from a pooled analysis standpoint. This is specifically PanTumor02, which we've all seen, where we saw dose reductions about 20%, okay? Dose reduction about 20%, interruptions about the same, but discontinuations were about 9%. We're going to talk much more about the ILD, so I'm not going to take too much time on that. Now, Topo 1 payloads are highly hematologic causing. Remember our basics sometimes. Sometimes we forget the basics, right? ASCO guidelines about for moderate risk nephritis neutropenia and consider if it's strongly. Age greater than 65, about half my patients. Poor performance status, I send those to Brian. Poor nutritional status, poor renal liver, cardiovascular disease, HIV. And then on the left, in recent infections, reading bottom to top, infections, pre-existing neutropenia, and previous chemotherapy at advanced stage. Basically, every one of our patients are eligible for prophylactic growth factor support. Strongly consider that in those patients. And when we really look at this and across 22,000 patients with T-DXd, all grades were about 40%. Grade 3, based on just the breast cancer literature, is about 20%. And remember to hold until resolve if it is grade 2, if it continues, dose reduce. I'm honored to work at this facility. We just opened up our second hospital, which now makes us, I believe, the second largest cancer hospital in the world. Now, cardiopulmonary. Actually, Ursula asked a question about the cardiac that we're going to come back to. But in the label, we still are expected to get echo or MUGAs. You know, it's in the... We don't do this in clinical practice, but baseline tropes are recommended. I shouldn't say we don't do this. I don't think about this. This is actually part of our oral set, as well as an EKG. And we're looking at this, making sure they're paying attention to the basic parameters from that standpoint. And if you see change in your left ventricular ejection fraction from baseline 10 to 20%, it's okay if it's less than that, and it's still greater than 45. But you fall to 45, which the incidence is less than 1%. In that case, you can continue treatment, repeat. But once you fall or you've had that greater than a 10 to 20% decrease, but you're still in that 40, 45, you may want to consider holding. And this is one of the cases we'll look at. Below 40% or greater than a 20% decrease from baseline, make sure you get a short interval scan, echo, and consider permanently discontinuation if somebody develops CHF. So this is a paper we all quote, but I went back and read this again, really trying to understand the underlying mechanism of action. And it's really an off-target toxicity with the pneumonitis and the ILD. But there's a rare type, what's called DAD, which is diffuse alveolar damage, which is often happens sooner and can be life-threatening. And this is the really important patient to pick up. But then you also have this continual, potentially lung injury that you'll see over time. We're gonna talk a little bit about the timing. So again, data we've seen before, looking at the TDXD experience over 1,000 patients with the overall occurrence of 15% of ILD, overall occurrence of 15%. When does it happen? 5.5 months on median. And remember that cycle 7 to 8. Often at that time, we're lulled into thinking they're fine. Remembering that almost all patients will be low grade, but we need to intervene and make sure we recognize it because in the original report, our fatal events were 2%. And this is the curve looking at the occurrence of ILD, and almost all of them are in the first 12 months. So you can relax a little bit after 12 months, but look at that median right there short of 6, but it can happen after your first cycle. I had one just recently. So please keep this curve in mind with the medians at about 5.5 for cycles 7 to 8, but it can happen at any time. And again, looking at now that same 1,500 patients across the TDXD trials, now with an adjudicated group, and this was by Dr., again, Paul Swain involved in this, but also Dr. Rugo and Dr. Park, who've involved in a lot of these trials, 12% overall occurrence, grade 3, 1%, grade 5, 1%. So the more experience we get, we're seeing less of these grade 5 toxicities. And of those that results in discontinuation, because of it, is about 9%. So when we look at those at the highest risk, and this is one of my favorite plots, because it really, when the patient's sitting in front of me, this is what I'm thinking about, how high to have that concern, or is it so high I may not consider TDXD, okay? So, younger patients, this is not consistent. Lung comorbidities is consistent, higher rate. Baseline renal function, especially moderate or severe, markedly higher risk. Been on treatment for a long time, and we've already talked about the dose of 5.4, which is really what we're looking at. Now, looking at this group of patients, again, when we combine, and this is a retrospective, only breast cancer, multi-institutional, and the overall adjudicated was about 9.5%. But they looked at the factors that were associated. Baseline shortness of breath, but The history of the lung disease didn't seem, but history of autoimmune disease and baseline interstitial lung abnormalities. The problem is most of the parts of the country, live in the Midwest, everybody has something on their scan. So I have a little bit of a hard time, but look at that hazard ratio, 17%. So I tried to dive down a little bit in that and how it was defined, and it wasn't clear. So we need more information on the severity and what we should pay attention to those interstitial lung abnormalities. But when I get that baseline CT to the chest, I'm thinking more about it. Now, prior lines of therapy, okay? And this is interesting because we get asked this all the time. Do you think prior IO therapies put you at increased risk? And based on their retrospective analysis, it may, and even those in a shorter interval, I'm not sure there's any difference between those at less than 6 months or within 3 months. But you do see some increase if you are in juxtaposition to the immune therapy, meaning a higher rate the sooner the immune therapy was, the more recent. So when we looked at multivariate predictors, again, these interstitial lung abnormalities on multivariate, HER2 was protective. I'm not sure why that is, with the off-target effect. And then patients who had poor lung disease to begin with. So what in my mind is consistent? Underlying lung disease, either based on CAT scan or history, renal dysfunction, the prior IO I'm still not convinced of, long treatment history, and older age, which again, you saw that younger age was actually a higher risk in one of the trials. We've all seen this. We should know this like the back of our hand right now. We need to get CAT scans. We should interrupt if we see or are concerned about interstitial lung disease. Get more information. Don't be afraid to start steroids. And in grade 2, permanently discontinued. This is what our current algorithm looks like. But I presented this last year. What has changed? What has changed is what we have patients who are getting amazing responses, and yet are they asking us, can I restart this, right? I want to, grade 3 or 4, get them in the hospital, take care of them, make sure you get a multidisciplinary approach. Don't even consider with regards to retreatment. I would argue grade 2 you shouldn't reconsider, but I'm going to call and talk out of both sides of my mouth, and you'll see that in a few minutes. Two recent publications, both in the last year. One look at the pooled analysis based on the TDXD experience. One looking at multi-institutional patients who are retreated after grade 1 and even grade 2. So on the left, there's 45 patients retreated grade 1, and on the right, 44 patients, and we're going to go through each one of these. Of the 45 that were retreated, you see that actually two-thirds of them had the same dose, and I would argue that it should have been dose reduced. And then the number of patients who were then received a second occurrence. So in those, and you can see right here, all right, 15 of the 45 had recurrence of their ILD. So one-third. So one-third recurred. Almost all of those were all grade 1 or 2. None were grade 3. So again, the recognition is so important. So those that showed complete resolution seemed to do a little bit better. And how about the multi-institution? Okay. So this case, of the re-challenge was 44 patients. And we look at those that had a recurrence from the original, that they were treated with steroids and the duration of steroids. After rechallenge, 12 patients, so 27%, pretty consistent, one-third of the patients had recurrence of their disease. And with regards to that, a little bit different. This is a little because the multi-institution wasn't as clean, but a very similar across those. Now, in this retrospective report, one had grade 3 that had recurrence. All the others were grade 1 and 2. It gives me a little confidence with regards there. They did report on 19 patients with grade 2. They were able to maintain that. Of those 19 patients, 3 developed recurrent. One of these were grade 4, one of these were grade 3. So our recommendation is don't go outside of a guideline therapy. There's limited data. I think when you have a patient without other options, this is a conversation that you can have, but I can't justify at this time treating. These are highly immunogenic agents. So let's change gears a little bit to GI. Treat them as highly immunogenic. Depending on the categories of consensus, some of them are moderate. Treat them as highly immunogenic. Make sure you're using triplet therapy. Make sure you're educating your patients. No reason to make your patient throw up before you treat. Don't be afraid to dose reduce. We seem to have activity, even in those patients. I didn't have time to include that data. They seem to continue to benefit. So take home message. ILD, 10 to 15% of patients. Fatal, about 1% are current, up to 2%. Cycle 7 to 8, almost all within 12 months. We talked about the high risk. Make sure you get early steroids on board. You can change the trajectory of those patients. If you're going to re-challenge, know that you have about a third risk of recurrent ILD. And at this point, I can't justify grade 2 because the higher occurrence and the small numbers that had recurrence. And we already talked about highly immunogenic. Remember your growth factors. Don't forget your basics and obviously highly immunogenic regimens. So thank you very much. And let's go to our cases.
Dr. Sakur told me about a 66-year-old woman with stage 2 carcinosarcoma of the uterus treated with surgery followed by paclitaxel carboplatin and then whole pelvic radiation and vaginal cuff brachytherapy. 2 years later, she presented with disease recurrence.
She had both a left sidewall recurrence and a vaginal cuff recurrence. She also had pulmonary nodules and a supraclav node. She underwent a supraclav node biopsy, which confirmed disease. She was on the Alliance AFT study, and she received atezolizumab and bevacizumab for 18 cycles. She had a really outstanding response. She actually discontinued IO due to adrenal insufficiency until, unfortunately, she recently progressed. She has no disease-related symptoms. HER2 was 3+, so really strong, intense staining there and a large number of cells being positive. So here's my quandary. What treatment would you recommend? Would you more likely go with a TDXD approach? So she read up a little bit about TDXD, and she consulted with Google in the AI mode. And she came to me. She was very worried about side effects like pneumonitis and nausea and vomiting, bone marrow suppression, and also cardiac toxicity. And I wanted to ask the group, you know, what mitigation strategies do you recommend when you start TDXD, and how do you counsel your patients? Do you ever start at a lower dose for TDXD? I have used TDXD a few times, as have my partners. I've been really impressed in terms of some patients do really, really well and seem to tolerate therapy without difficulty, whereas other people have significant issues, specifically neutropenia, nausea, and vomiting. Another question I have for the panelists is how they manage the antiemetic strategy for patients that are on TDXD. How do they monitor for ILD and also the cardiac toxicity? Are you doing interval and frequent CT scans of the chest and echo? And how often do you do them? When would you get a pulmonary consult? Another question I have for the panelists is for a patient who has grade 1 ILD, would you consider rechallenge with TDXD?
So I went very quickly. And Angela just asked us like 37 questions. So we can see if we can get to a few of them, right? So very, very quickly, I believe strongly no greater than 9-week interval in this consensus, mostly consensus guidelines say that 9-week interval on CT the chest while somebody's on TDXD. Some people have chosen to use 6-week intervals, which is part of many clinical trials, and then do abdomen and pelvis at that 12-week intervals. I tend to do all three of them at every 3 cycles, every 9-week intervals. Angela, grab anything there, but, you know, I guess, Joyce, what are each one of your institutions, Joyce and Brian, what are each one of your institutions doing in screening and then surveillance for ILD? If you want to also discuss Joyce take on cardiac and Brian take on GI.
Yeah, so for ILD, I do exactly the same thing that you do, Dave. I do every 9 weeks. If I have concerns, so if somebody's at one of those higher risk factors that you point out, I may do their CT chest at every 6 week winter interval. So I do think about the risk for the patient. And then in terms of cardiac screening, I do baseline echo, and then I do echo at least every 3 months unless I see something different.
Yeah, no, thanks for that. And it seems like we all agree. I think 9 week screening with imaging makes sense. I get pulmonary involved so quickly. Right. I mean, it's really, in my view, a team approach. You know, I think oftentimes we like to do as much as we can for our patients, but I think it's important to have a pulmonary doctor on board when there's any early signs of any changes for two reasons: help me management, but also to help reconfirm for me that maybe it is okay to restart, maybe to reconfirm for me that it's not progressing, it's something that's okay, so the patient can get the benefit of it. Yeah. So I think, yeah.
A good pulmonary doc. You know, I just had a recent pulmonary consult by a local who's, platinum-resistant ovarian cancer, getting an amazing response, and there's a little fluffiness on the scan. I've never looked at more CTs of the chest. I should say, over the last 25 years, I've looked at more CAT scans in the last year compared to 25 combined. I look at all my own scans now, and if I have questions, I'll absolutely get pulmonary involved. But I had a pulmonologist who was like, oh, you have to discontinue right away. And I was like, I mean, I'm not sure. So I think having somebody you can trust and have that dialogue. Joyce, you're going to say something.
I was just going to say that, you know, in addition to that, the other reason, and I involve pulmonary very soon, is because sometimes something might look like ILD, and it is not. And I'm not saying that that's always true, but you do have to think about that. People can get other things, and actually I recently had a case of somebody who had had one cycle of TDXD. She wasn't feeling great. I scanned her lungs. It looked bad, and I was like, oh, this is really early. I hospitalized her. I had her bronched. She had a pneumonia. And she had, like, she didn't look sick enough for a pneumonia, but it turned out to be a pneumonia, not TDXD, ILD.
So I think we use what's called the intermediate care center, where we take them in, we get a viral panel. I can have pulmonary CM right there. But to bring that patient in and at times bronch them and get that multidisciplinary, especially if somebody looks sick, that's, you know, get them in, start steroids, start antibiotics. You can always stop. But if you miss that window, they can get sicker than the Dickens on you, and it's really important. Brian, you're going to say something.
You know, again, our rule, first rule is to do no harm. So, yes, rule out ILD, but if we do rule it out, again, you're giving him a good treatment option. And you don't want to withhold the treatment option if you don't have to. So I had a similar case that looked like ILD, so a good pulmonologist got her back on therapy. She was responding.
Joyce, I really dove into this data this year because, again, because of the now we have some retreatment data in the literature, so they've been presented nationally or internationally, now we have those publications. I mean, it made me rethink some of this. Are you retreating with grade one? I won't ask you grade two yet, but I'd love for you to comment on it. And are you dose reducing if you do retreat?
So I do retreat grade one. So we treat, you want it to resolve, but asymptomatic radiographic pneumonitis, I treat. I will retreat with this sort of knowledge that those patients may recur, and those patients I monitor very carefully at retreatment. Those people get every 6 week scans.
Yeah.
Grade two, I struggle because there's grade two, and then there's and they're like, oh, you know, don't tell me about your cough because maybe it's not a grade two. But like, I don't retreat grade two right now. I'm worried, just like you do, on the literature. We don't have enough data to tell us it's safe.
Brian, anything to add? And, you know, are you using the highly immunogenic regimens with regards to the pulmonary? But then second is a follow-up. Are you using highly immunogenic regimens for your prophylaxis on GI?
I am. I want to give them the best shot of keeping in the drug. So I think that's consistent, probably what you guys are doing.
Yeah.
To that point, I agree. I don't restart grade two. I'm scared about that.
So we talked about GCSS. I think we addressed that. I believe we have one more video. Why don't we start that? We're going to come answer some of these questions about the new therapies.
The next case, presented by Dr. Matalonis, is a 55-year-old woman who presented with ovarian cancer and a genomic instability score of 50. The patient was treated with surgery, carboplatin paclitaxel, followed by maintenance with olaparib and bevacizumab, and 4 months after completing therapy, disease progression was noted.
Folate receptor alpha of 90%, HER2 IHC 2+, NGS showed a TMB1, BRCA1/2 wild type, germline testing negative. Her past medical history was cardiomyopathy, hypertension, elevated cholesterol, and she's being actively followed by cardiology. And so far, she's received mirvetuximab, was on mirvetuximab for about 8 months, then started having progression, and then started on trastuzumab deruxtecan because of the 2+ HER2. So her echo at the start of TDXD showed an ejection fraction of 47%, cardiology following along. After 2 cycles, ejection fraction 48%, and then started to drop a little bit, asymptomatic. So after 7 cycles, when that ejection fraction dropped to 39%, did not give her any more TDXD. So my question to this group would be, what has been your experience using trastuzumab deruxtecan in patients with underlying cardiac disease? And after she progressed through TDXD, what treatment would you have given her?
So did she actually respond to the TDXD?
She did. Oh, absolutely. Yeah, she had a response. She had shrinkage. Another question for the great panel is, what are your practices to sequence the ADCs that we have available to us off of a clinical trial, specifically mirvetuximab and trastuzumab deruxtecan?
Boy, we're down the last couple of minutes, and she threw us a doozy. Brian, I think you really addressed this with regards to sequencing some of how you look at endometrial. Joyce, ovary, how are you working with the sequencing? You know, I think... You know, for me, I almost never disagree with Ursula. I think I probably would have continued therapy there to reduce dose. You know, she didn't fall more than 10%. She was still in that 40% range in a person. So I may have continued therapy there with dose reduction. But I think safety, discontinuing that therapy. But the last question she asked, regards to some of the sequencing and that we're looking at, we're down the last couple of minutes. How are you managing this going forward?
So I think a lot about payloads and targets, and Brian alluded to this earlier. Like when we think about ADC after ADC and we're switching payloads, I have a little bit more comfort that we're going to be less likely to see cross-resistance. It's not 100%. I think it's also true that even if you have the same target, we are starting to see emerging data, and we see this in breast cancer with HER2, that you can come with 2 ADCs with the same target and different payloads, and they have sequential activity.
Yeah.
Where I think we don't know the answer is when we come in with a Topo-1 payload ADC and then a second Topo-1 ADC, are we going to see attenuated activity of that second Topo-1 ADC from what we would expect? And that's going to make it really important, if that's true, that when we think about what Topo-1 ADC are we going to reach for in our patients, this isn't just ovary, this is across all of our GYN cancer patients, that we're choosing whichever one based upon the biology of that cancer, maybe its expression of its target, that is going to be the most active one.
So what I'm hearing, I'm going to paraphrase here, you have concerns about Topo-1 payload, same payload or similar payload, after similar payload, even if it has a different target.
Yes.
Different payloads with a different target, not as much concern. How about different payloads, same target?
Different payloads, same target, I also feel like we're starting to see emerging data that is potentially going to have sequential activity.
Brian, any last thoughts?
Yeah, no, I agree completely. I mean, I think she alluded to, you know, MIRV or TDXD. I mean, I like starting with mirvetuximab. It's a demonstrated, proven overall survival advantage, and then still have TDXD available.
I promise you 2:15. It's exactly 2:15. Thank you so much for your attention. Thank you, Joyce, Brian. Wonderful discussion. Thank you to those, our thought leaders, Second Opinion. Thank you very much.